It is my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Mike L. from Indianapolis, Indiana.
My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date, September 7th, 1985, and that just shocks the heck out of me. I had no plan. I didn't have a track record that would support that. My home group's the Dignitary Sympathy Group in Indianapolis, Indiana. It's a typical piece of alcoholic bait and switch. We have no dignitaries and we offer no sympathy, but it seems to make us attractive in the directory. So, before we go any further, could we have another round of applause for Joanne? She did a fantastic job here. I really identified with her story. I mean, I started at 12, but it looked a lot like she described. Welcome to all those, there are quite a few here that are 30 days and less, and I want to welcome you to this this meeting. Hopefully something may happen that may be worthwhile for you, some kind of a takeaway. I'll talk briefly about my drinking history and what getting sober. Unfortunately, I don't know, some of you may not relate. I seem to have had a great deal of trouble since I've been sober. So go figure. I'm the oldest of four children. I grew up in the Midwest in a college town, Iowa City, Iowa. I came from a normal family, but I'll tell you I came from a functional family. And what that means to me is that the family would have problems from time to time, frequently as a result of yours truly. But when the family had problems, they got together and they addressed those problems and faced up to them and moved along. I tended not to do that. I say that pretty much every time I talk because I went around for years lying about my family. When I got here, I was so desperate to belong to something. I misunderstood a whole series of misunderstandings. I thought I needed a dysfunctional family in order to fit into Alcoholics Anonymous, so I invented a dysfunctional family and a whole bunch of stuff and told lies about them. So my continuing amends to my family is to tell you the truth about them. My drinking was chaotic from the beginning. Snapshots, what it looked like, maybe 15 years old, school night, middle of the week, small town Midwest, so they didn't lock the doors and left their keys in their car. And so I'd come stumbling in around midnight. I wasn't old enough to drive yet, I remembered that. And I'd make some noise and that would wake my mother up and she'd say, "Mike, is that you?" And I'd swear at her, and that was really dumb because that got my father up. And I favor my mother. My father went to college on a football scholarship and played tackle for Drake University for 3 years, so waking him up wasn't a good idea. And even though he was a big man, he was a gentleman, so he could have easily just decked me, but he wouldn't. But he'd say, "You know, son, you're not going to talk to your mother like that." And then I'd do the next crazy thing and take a swing at him. And he'd have mercy on me, and the next thing, we're rolling around on the floor, and I'm 15, I can cause him a little trouble, and he's trying to restrain me, and I'm trying to slam his head through the kitchen cupboards. And my younger brothers and sister are up, and they're crying, and they're upset because they're afraid their big brother and their dad are going to hurt each other. Another snapshot a year or two later, because I've got a driver's license now, and we're sitting around the family dinner table, and my sister had one of these wooden hope chests, you know, and that chest was sitting in the middle of the table, and we were having a family meeting about what had happened to Carol's babysitting money that she'd been saving for a special occasion. It had just disappeared, and everybody seemed to be looking at me when they asked their questions about this. And I did what I always did, is I got indignant, I stared him right down and I said, "You know, what in the hell are you looking at me for? I don't know anything about this. Why would I know anything about her babysitting money? Well, the truth was that her big brother had stolen her money and bought a keg the weekend before so I could throw the party and be the big man out at the lake that weekend. And the reason I mentioned that is because I got here under the illusion that there was a period where I experienced normal drinking. And when I looked at the truth of what my drinking history was, I was immediately, as a young teenager, too young to drive, bringing violence into my home, and I was already stealing from the get-go to support my habit. And I haven't found that as a part of any social drinking definition that I've seen yet. So, I went to college. I went on spring break. I didn't come back from spring break. That was not a bright thing to do in 1966. And so I found myself in Uncle Sam's army and in Vietnam. I survived the war and came back and resumed my college studies again. And what can I tell you about it? More chaotic. I saw some friends from school a while ago, and one guy said, you know, I remembered you that 8 o'clock English class you had, and he said, and you had coping skills even then. The only way you could make the 8 o'clock class is when you were through drinking the night before, you'd go to sleep under the bushes outside the classroom door. And so, you know, when they'd come in for class the next day, they'd just wake me up. Where the end of the drinking took me was I had some financial success, but that's all gone. I used to say I was living with a woman. The truth was I was living off a woman. And I wasn't raised to do that. That wasn't the ethic I was raised with. But I'm using this woman. I'm living off her. She's got a job, and that makes me a functional alcoholic. It's funny how we turn a whole system around because we were playing I didn't know it at the time, but I'm on an allowance. I'm living there, and she gets up and goes to work. I get up whenever I can, make myself a drink, go sit on the edge of the tub by the toilet and try and get the first drink to stay down. And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, but I'm not doing anything till that first drink stays down. She comes home from work, and would you believe it, before she comes into the apartment, she takes the money out of her purse, decides how much she's going to let me steal that night. That's how much she leaves in her purse, and the rest of it goes under the carpeting in the trunk of her car. And we pretended like I'm going to get a job again and be back in the big time, and I'm here to tell you that you can live like that one day at a time. Matter of fact, that's about the only way you can live like that. I caught a wind of grace one morning on that bathroom floor when I'm crawling around and the whiskey wasn't staying down, and I was in total despair, and for reasons I don't know to this day and I guess aren't important, I decided to try and get sober one more time. And by this time, I've been showing up in treatment facilities and detox units for a little better than 6 years, even occasionally in an AA meeting. My friends, my drinking buddies, the ones that needed to get sober, they're sober. Some of them are sober 10 years now at that point. And I've tried, I thought I've done everything they did, and it doesn't seem to be working for me. And I decided to try one more time to get sober. And so that sweet lady I had this old drunk car, and she filled it up with gas, gave me a $20 bill and a pint of light Bacardi rum, and I set off to find sobriety. And I'm confused. I'm living in Indianapolis, Indiana, and the only place I can remember, because the insurance is long gone, the money's long gone, everything's long gone, the only thing I can think of is I remember that there's a veterans place somewhere in Iowa, and so I set off for that. I didn't know that there was a veterans place in Indianapolis. There was a veterans place. I was really disappointed when I found out I drove past a veterans place with a nine-hole golf course and a fishing pond in Danville, Illinois on the way to this, but not my fate. And where this journey took me, I couldn't, it was Labor Day weekend in 1985, and in the Midwest, I don't need to tell you about hot out here, but it was very hot there, and very humid, and the air conditioning in my car, of course, didn't work, and I'm not doing very well, and the pint's gone, and I can't make it. Where I end up pulling off the road is the exit off Interstate 80 from my old hometown. And my father's dead by this time, and my mother, and I've got mother and two brothers that still live there. But I can't go there. Not because they wouldn't help me, but because one of the things that broke in me was that I lost my capacity to continue to hurt the people I love the most. One of the things that finally broke this tough guy was that I'd look the people I loved in the eye, and I couldn't make the promise anymore and give them the hope, because time after time, I would create hope in their eyes and hope in their lives, and they'd say, this time our brother's getting better, and this time my son's going to make it, and it looked like it for a while, and then I just jerked the rug out from under them, and I just could not go near them and do that to them anymore. And I understand today that's a blessing. What that means is I'm not a sociopath or a psychopath. I do care. I cannot hurt people with impunity and not suffer consequences for it. I'd like to at times, but I can't. Where I ended up was on the front porch of the parents of my best friend and drinking buddy from high school. And I'd made fun of these people. Buck and his wife had gotten sober a few years before, and old Buck had been a paratrooper in World War II, and he used to send me money when I was in the Army, and I'd be broke, and I'd get a letter from Buck, and he says, well, I know it's about a week before payday, and you've got to be broke by now, so here, have some money and go party on me. And Buck had gotten sober, and good grief, he and his wife were praying and talking about God, and I didn't like any of that. And I'd made fun of them, I'd badmouthed them, probably church puppies was the nicest thing I called them. And I'm on the doorstep, and I can't make the last 100 miles to this VA center, and I'm dying. And so I knocked on the door, and they opened the door, and they looked at each other and then looked at me, and both put their arms around me and just drew me into the living room. And without saying anything else, they just held me in their arms there and said a prayer right then and there for me to get better. And then they put me to bed. Buck was a practical man. He gave me a drink and put me to bed. And the next day, drove me the last 100 miles. And you know, funny thing, that treatment center didn't have a different 12-step program than any of the other ones I'd been to. Nothing was different at that, but what was different was me. And I believe from that day to this that my real journey wasn't to that facility, that my real journey was to that prayer, sort of the willingness to allow somebody to say a prayer for me, the willingness to open my heart up to a power greater than myself that might heal me. You see, I wasn't against God. I just didn't believe God was going to be a practical answer for the high class problems that I had. What I did is I went through that treatment facility, and I made two important vital decisions there that I'd never made before. That first night there on my knees, I did something that I'd never done before. I asked for help from a God I didn't even have a conception of. I was telling some people this afternoon that at that time, all I could come up with for a prayer was, I'm 37 years old, and all I can say is, now I lay me down to sleep. But you know, God didn't wait for a real high-class prayer from me. He didn't wait for a fancy prayer. I got the help right then and there. What I I also made a decision that I was going to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a member like I see around groups like this, where people are active and they're not just keeping a chair warm, that they're being a vital part of their community and participating in the recovery and carrying this message. And I did that. I jumped out of there and I went to about becoming a member of AA with a vengeance. You know, I did it. Whew. I went to somewhere between 11 and 18 meetings a week for years. And a funny thing happened just before I was going to celebrate my fifth anniversary. I didn't want to drink, but what I did is I wanted to die. I'm trying, there's something wrong with your sobriety if you're driving around the Beltline trying to figure out a way to kill yourself so it won't embarrass the people you sponsor. This is not good recovery. And the short version of the story is that what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous was the same thing I did years before when I went to the University of Iowa. I went to the University of Iowa and went over to the field house and I registered for my classes, and I went down to the student bookstore and I bought all my books. And then I joined a fraternity. I threw the books in the closet and started partying. And when you ran into me on campus, if you'd asked me what I was doing, I would have told you I was a pre-law student at the University of Iowa. And that was technically true. But the fact is, I almost never went to class. And what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I was ubiquitous at your meetings. If anything was going on, I never missed a dance, I never missed a party, I never missed a convention, I never missed activity. I started a meeting, I was secretary of this, and the only thing I left out of this was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got my life saved by the guy I disliked most in Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. That step working, step Nazi, blah, 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 blah guy I really didn't like. And I told, I'm not telling you a secret, I told him that directly at the time. I can't go into that whole story now, but the man that I disliked most in Alcoholics Anonymous extended the lifeline to me, and he did beautiful things. Gary was 27 years sober at the time in one of the local gurus, or at least that's what I would have described him, and he did beautiful things in addition to helping me through the steps really for the first time, not where I just read them and agreed with them, but actually did them. I still remember having lunch with him one day and coming out from that lunch, and he said to me, and I'm the nobody guy, and he says, Mike, I need to talk to you for a minute. And he said, you know, I was at work this morning, and I was dishonest with somebody on a transaction at work, and I should have given a coworker credit for this transaction, and I credited this transaction to my account so I'd make the commissions on it because this guy isn't here today and everything else. And I'm going to go back and see the manager when I return to work today, and here's what I'm going to do about it. And my jaw just dropped open. See? He was doing the deal. He was showing me an example. He didn't tell me what I needed to do. He showed me from a 27-year standpoint what a grown-up member of Alcoholics Anonymous, how they conducted themselves in their lives. I saw that, yes, we make mistakes, and sometimes they're serious ones. But we fortunately, and with God's grace, have a way to set those things right. I got this education just in time because I found out that another piece of my image was going. My marriage, I didn't know it, but we were going to have a divorce at my house. And I went from my this image that I created myself for myself to, I'm 6 years sober, and I'm living in a sleeping bag on the floor of the den of one of my buddies in the program. And this is not how I pictured life at 6 years sober. I found out the other day, I was having lunch with a guy. He said, you know, you remember when you were living in the sleeping bag and everything else? And I said, yeah, Steve, I remember that. He says, well, you know, I was new then. And he says, I kept waiting for you to drink. He says, I knew you were going to drink, what with the divorce and all that stuff. And I found out that not only did the work I'd been doing with others help save my life at that time, that it was a useful thing for others. And so survived it. I got a little time here, and I want to talk about two things, I think, if you'd allow me here. Since this is the specific group, I want to get specific with you. I want to talk to you about two things. I want to talk to you about perhaps the most important prayer that's been given to me since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe some of the way that's touched my life. And I want to tell you about the most important question I've been asked so far since I've been sober. The background on this prayer it came, like many of my treasures, it came out of resentment. I just about as soon as Lori and I were able to come to terms and settle the divorce that I desperately did not want to have, I finally got to start spending time with my 6-year-old son again. And so it's Saturday night, and Andrew is 6, and he says, you know, Dad, he says, I'd like to go out and have a grown-up dinner tonight. He says, I don't want to go to McDonald's or, you know, one of those places, or Applebee's. He says, I'd like to go to a grown-up place. So I said, okay, Andrew, we'll do that. And so I took Andrew, and we went to a grown-up restaurant on Friday night, and we're having a great time. And all of a sudden, I look around, and everybody here has got a date, and I'm with a 6-year-old. And it just crushed. The wave of self-pity hit me like a tsunami. And I'm well enough trained by this that I didn't treat my son badly. I stayed present, and I was and paid attention to him. But we finished up dinner and went home, saw the video or whatever, and I gave him a bath and put him to bed. And then I got my pen out, and I got busy writing some inventory. And I'll share just a spritz of that with you. And I'll tell you that, you know, we scare a lot of people with inventory around here. I hear people, oh, you've got to be careful. You don't want to do that 4-step too quick. Oh, you know, you might upset you. You might get drunk. I want to tell you that all of these tools, all 12 of them, are loving tools given to me as life-saving, life-giving instruments of God's mercy and peace in my experience. And inventory is one of those blessings. Now, I want to tell you, this is not an example, because if I was writing this inventory today, I'd write it differently. But this is just the way it was back then. And who do I resent? Well, I resent God. Why? Well, I resent God because I don't have the relationship that I want to have with a woman. I think God's only going to give me the choice between having a sick relationship or no relationship. I'm lonely. People I sponsor are having better relationships than I am. I'm afraid that God will keep me in this pain because I'll be more useful to others this way than if I have the relationship I want. I really hate to read this next part. I feel like God has given me a gift of communicating with others, and the price of the gift is my own happiness. I'm mad because I know only God can help me, and I don't believe he cares. Yeah. Well, I didn't tell you it'd be pretty here. That saying is never true. Enlightenment is just the ultimate disappointment of my ego. If I'm willing to not look hip, slick, or cool, it's amazing how easy things get. What did all this affect? Well, it affected my self-esteem. I felt that I'd sell out my principles to have a comfortable relationship. In fact, I might do something like hitting on a newcomer. As a result, I feel like a phony. Well, because I'm a phony. It's distorted my sex relations. I'm having an increasingly emotionally unsatisfying sex-only relationship. I decided that I was going to manage my sex life. And the way I was going to do this is I was going to find somebody who was not in Alcoholics Anonymous and who just, we called it racquetball. No dates, no dinners, no flowers. We'll just get together and mutually agreed upon times and have sex to our heart's content. That way I can, that's my answer to fix my relationship troubles. I mean, as usual, my solutions are worse than my, it's my solutions that are killing me here. I've started to buy porn again, and et cetera, et cetera. It affects my personal relations and keeps me jealous of everybody else and comparing and coveting what they have. I'm absolutely unwilling to share my pain around this. I feel ashamed apart from indifferent. I'm flawed. My unbalanced drive in this area makes me vulnerable to getting drunk. Compromising my principles will get me drunk, and I know I don't have the strength not to do this. Then I get over here to my mistakes. Well, I'm not willing to give this to God because I don't think he's interested or willing to help me. I'm willing to shell out all my principles just to get relief. I want Miss Right now, not Miss Right. I'm absolutely not willing to take an honest look at what this fantasy relationship won't do for me. And I'm wanting somebody else. I want to steal self-esteem, self-worth, and everything else, and sense of well-being from somebody else. I want somebody else to fill me up, and only God can do that. As soon as I finished that, I immediately called Gary up, the guy I didn't like, and read it to him. When I was through with him, I started working my way west across the time zones and got my friend Don in Denver. Don asked me a few questions that set me on the path there. He said, describe this, this woman that you think you need to me. And I did, and I explained who she was, what she looked like, what she did, and all this whole thing. And he listened to this whole thing. And then at the end of it, he says, well, Mike, let me ask you this. He said, in the event that such a woman exists, why would she want to have anything to do with you? And he told me that one of those pieces of truth. He says, Mike, it's not about finding the right person. It's about you becoming the right person. He said, if you become the right person, the other person will automatically show up. God's not going to mess with some woman's life in order to make your life better. It just doesn't work that way. I wish I could tell you it was all neat and tidy from that point, but Don Gay also asked me to say a prayer, and this is the prayer. He said, I want you to pray this prayer and this prayer and nothing else. I said, okay. And he says, the prayer is just this: God, please teach me about love. And I said, okay, and I hung up. And 2 weeks later, I called him back, and I told him, because I've been taught I can complain when I don't get the results from my guru that I think I should get. And I said, Don, I said, you need to know I don't think much of your damn prayer. And he says, well, cowboy, tell me what's been going on. And I says, well, first of all, the only woman that was a real good prospect just got a job transfer, and she's moved out of town, and that's all over. And he said, and then I went to the doctor the other day, and they gave me some medication that's made me impotent. And he laughed and he said, well, I think you misunderstood the prayer. He says, I bet you thought the prayer was, God, get me a woman. He says, the prayer is, God, please teach me about love. And he says, hang with me on this, cowboy, and let's talk again. And so I reluctantly started praying the prayer, and I found out that God will begin to turn my heart even when I don't, if I have the smallest sliver of willingness. And so I started with this prayer, and then an amazing thing happened. I realized one Friday night on the way over to my ex-wife's house that I was just wildly and completely and crazily and dizzily in love with my son. You know, he and his mother had always had a different relationship than he and I had. And we hadn't had a bad relationship. But all of a sudden, whatever was there in between was just gone. I've had the privilege of being deliriously in love with my son for many years now. It's been a great blessing. And then the next thing I realized not long after that is that I love my ex-wife. I didn't want to be married to her again. But what happened was God restored her to the place in my heart that she had before we got married. Amends had been made and so forth. I'm probably one of the few guys I've listened. My ex-wife is a member of this program a year longer than I am. I got to listen to my ex-wife's inventory one time. I'll tell you, in case anybody thinks that's a great idea, that's probably the biggest ego reduction exercise that I've been through in my life. We were coming home. The first thing we were able to do together after the divorce is we went to a PTA meeting one night, and we're driving home from the PTA meeting, and I turned to Lori and I says, you know, I said, I think the only bad feelings I've got left from the divorce, I says, is that it interrupted our friendship. And that beautiful woman turned to me with a huge smile on her face, and she says, well, Michael, did you ever consider that it was the marriage that interrupted our friendship? And what we found out, and we agree today, is that, you know, we're two people that are well suited to being each other's good friends. But we're alcoholics, so more seemed like better, and so we got married. And what happened here was that God lovingly restored us to where we needed to be in relation to each other. And I don't have a better friend or supporter today than my ex-wife. I got a gift from her last year, and it's one of those gifts that's so hard to come by. Andrew had, they live in another state now, and Andrew, he's pretty much all grown up, but Lori called me and she says, I just wanted to tell you, he brought his prom date by the other night, and she's a beautiful gal, and he was such a gentleman around her and treating her so well. And I said, Andrew, I really love the way you're treating your date. And he looked at me and he says, well, Mom, I learned how to do that from Mike. I got that gift from my ex-wife. See, if I don't put limits on what's possible in God's world, it's amazing the gifts that come my way. I want to tell you a little bit about a related matter, the question. I wrote some other inventory, and I won't bore you with all of that sniveling, but, you know, it kept coming up in the fourth column of this inventory that I was unwilling or unable to trust God. Unwilling or unable to trust God was kind of a theme through all of this stuff, and I shared this with a number of people and eventually got to sharing it with Don. And Don listened, and then he said, you know, Mike, I've known you for quite a while now. And he said, in my experience with you, he says, you're a man who I believe would very much like to trust God. And so if there's you're not able to trust God and you really want to, there's obviously something blocking you. Let's look. Everybody else had talked about the details of the inventory, and Don got right into my conception of God. And he said, let's see what your conception of God is. And at that time, I was operating from a conception roughly that you might call God the Father. As I told you, my father had been a pretty good guy, and so I didn't have any baggage there. But I got taken back as I did a little writing about this. I got taken back to a place at that same family kitchen table there that I'm a young guy. I'm back from Vietnam, and I'm sitting at that table with my dad, and there's a pile of my bad checks in front of my father. And my dad, my hero, is looking at me, and this big guy has got tears in his eyes, and he says, "Son, I love you more than anything else in the world, and I would do anything in the world to help you. But the more I help you, it seems like the more you screw up. What am I going to do with you?" And you see, I didn't realize it. Without realizing it, I had an idea. God was the Father, and I heard God saying to me, "Look at all I've done for you. I've given you careers. I've given you money. I've given you relationships. I saved your life in Vietnam. I saved your life from alcoholism, and you keep screwing up. What am I going to do with you?" See, what was perfectly appropriate for my human father today, say, when I projected it on to my higher power, was something that, without even my realizing, it had gotten in my way. Matter of fact, Don told me that my basic problem over the years was that, you know, he says, "As near as I can tell, God created you in His image, and you've tried to return the favor on a regular basis ever since." I've created a series of deities in my own image. You know, if I'd be angry, God must be angry. If I would do this or feel this, God must feel that way. And all I was doing, or, you know, I can change, God will love me if I'm good, or God will punish me if I'm bad. Oh, well, so I've created a God that I can push around with my behavior. I can change God according to how I act. Isn't that an interesting thing? And so while my conception of God the Father to get it, make a beginning was very important, it was now the very thing. The thing that started me on the path was now the thing keeping me from continuing my journey. And I had to make some changes here, and where that took me was, you know, what is my conception of a higher power? And it came down to me for lack of a better description, what I would call my four pillars, if you will. The first thing God needs to be for me is God's not angry. I don't know about you, but I don't want to have an intimate relationship with somebody who's angry and where I'm coming up short and I'm not ever going to be good enough and everything else. I don't open up for that. See, believing in God isn't enough for me. I must have a relationship, and that's an entirely different thing. And so the number one characteristic of the God of my understanding today is God's not angry. And the second piece of that is the God of my understanding doesn't think comparatively. I didn't understand a thing about God until I understood God loved me just as much when I was standing in a liquor store writing a bad check to buy a bottle of liquor to go seduce my neighbor's wife as He does when I'm out holding out my hand to a newcomer and trying to save their life. You know, I get different consequences for those actions. Don't mistake what I'm saying. But God loves me the same in both places. I can't change God. I'm as close to God right now in this moment as I'm ever going to be in my life if I spend the rest of it on my knees chanting prayers or doing anything else. The only thing that changes is my awareness of that. God has always been present in my life. God has always loved me wildly and completely. I've been blind to that. and waking up to that has revolutionized my life. So, and then the third one is the question that was asked to me that changed everything and kind of pulled it all together. And a man asked me, he said, Mike, what would your life look like if you took the position that God wants your happiness more than you do yourself? And it cracked me wide open. See, I knew God wanted me to be good. I knew God wanted me to work hard. I knew God wanted me to sacrifice for others. I knew God wanted me to be honest. I never got that the number one thing God wanted was my happiness. And this guy went on very quickly to point out that there's a big difference between happiness and pleasure. You know, it's kind of like the difference between wholesome, nutritious food and gobbling up a pint of Häagen-Dazs as quick as you can. You know, one may make you feel good, but you'll pay a price for it later on. And there's never a price. There's never a downside to happiness. Now I've got a higher power that's not angry with me, that loves me wildly, and wants my happiness. You know, I can show up for that relationship. I'm interested. Before I answered that question, I'd had a relationship with God kind of like I had with the IRS. You know, I knew I couldn't, you know, I couldn't wish him away. I had to do business with him, but I wasn't going to have much more contact than was absolutely necessary. And I certainly didn't really want to open up the books and let him have a good look. You know? And now all of a sudden, I got a God that wants my happiness more than even I do myself. And then the final piece of that was, just said, if you believe that, Mike, he said, would you be willing to consider that perhaps God might know what would make you happy more than you do yourself? And what a wonderful thing. That's where all the years of inventory and everything started to come together. I saw the evidence was right there in my own handwriting on all those pages of inventory that I'd spent my whole life, if you wanted to sum it up, it had been dedicated to me trying to make me happy. You know, sometimes I tried to make myself happy by making you happy, but it was all the bottom line. It all came back to me trying to make me happy. And so here was time for the performance review. You know, how good a job have I done? I'd spent my entire life up to this point dedicated to trying to create my own happiness. Was there any reason, rational reason, for me to believe that I was going to do any better job the next half of my life than I'd done with the first half? And the answer for me was no. And that changes everything. You know, if I wanted to kill an alcoholic, if I wanted to kill a sober alcoholic, I don't think I'd need to give you a drink. I don't think I'd need to bring tragedy in your life. I don't think I'd need to do any of those things. If I wanted to assassinate a sober alcoholic, all I'd do is plant the notion in the back of your mind that your spiritual condition depend in your relationship with the God of your understanding depends upon how you feel. And that's all I'd need to do is put that thought there and walk away. In my experience, absent some intervention, terrible things are ahead. Because, you know, my experience is that there are many times, in fact, frequently, that I don't feel at all close to that God that I know what loves me wildly. I'm sure God's made a terrible error on what's going on in my life. On and on and on. But if I've been willing to persist and continue to show up in that relationship with that power greater than myself through those times, when the prayers seem dry, when the meditation, my nose itches, and all I can see is naked ladies running across my field of vision while I'm trying to meditate, you know, all these kind of things, And I'm going, no, you know, this worked for a while. There was a while that that meditation made me feel better. There was a while that prayer seemed to be getting me what I wanted. There was a while, and it just doesn't feel right anymore. And I slowly turn my back on God, and I walk in back into the shadows, kind of like those concentration camp survivors that they found in Europe after the war. They set many of them free, and the survivors of those terrible camps walked out into the sunlight, and the sunlight was so bright that some of them turned around and walked back into their prison. And then, you know, haven't I just been that way so many times? The God of my understanding, sending his love through people like you, has brought me into the sunlight of the Spirit. And from time to time, driven by my feelings, I choose to turn around and walk back into the shadows. I thank God that people like you have not allowed me to stay there. There's always somebody that I sponsor giving me a phone call. I hear from somebody else. And you draw me back into the sunlight. What a wonderful thing. I never knew if you'd ask me what I wanted to do with my life, what would be the most exciting thing I could possibly do. It wouldn't have been this. But I'll tell you, I'm absolutely delighted and excited to be able to get with people and tell them how much I love that God of my understanding, how much he's done for me, and to thank you and thank you and thank you for making that relationship possible. Because without you, that relationship would have never happened and never been possible. Thank you very much to this group for bringing me out here and letting me see so many of my friends again. And please always remember me as loving you. Thank you.